Hello everyone and welcome back to the Damage Report. I'm John Adarola. We've got a big old week developing here and we decided, you know what? We're gonna bring on a special guest to walk us through the latest updates on who's got COVID, whose state's election results might possibly be overturned, who's talking with aliens. We've got none other than actor, writer, producer, commentator, director, comedian, Brian Unger back on the Damage Report. Brian, how's it going?
America's favorite Jewish lawyer is here to help you through all of the mess. John, I couldn't be happier to see you guys again. It's been a while since little bug's been going around. I've been reading about. So
yeah, it's a big deal, supposedly. And so you live sort of near LA, right? I don't know if it's technically LA, but near LA.
Adjacent. I'm in the part of LA where the real estate prices have always kind of been depressed, but now that people are freaked out about COVID, they really want to live where I live because there's so much space to roam. And you know, because I live on a little ranch with horses and dogs and chickens and pigeons and all kinds of wildlife. So I'm not going to tell you the exact address, but I live in the Angeles National Forest somewhere.
Yeah, no. I didn't want to ask. I was hoping you'd just offer your exact address so somebody could visit you during the show. Do you have a pig? That's my follow-up question for you.
I don't have a pig, and because of the rooting issue, they're adorable. I've always wanted one. I want goats too, but they crap everywhere. So I have to. I live in a fecal war zone, so I have to kind of be particular about what I'm cleaning, because I am cleaning and I'm covered in DNA all day long, every day of miscellaneous fecal matter from every species you can imagine. So I have to be very selective. And so I'm limiting myself to mostly raising chickens. I've really enjoyed that. I actually really, really like it. Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, we're learning a lot about you. The white shirt is a bold choice considering the fecal spray you so constantly have to dodge.
I so rarely get out of pajamas, which everybody says. I never put on white because I'm usually covered in some kind, I'm soiled somehow. And then just this idea of seeing you right here and knowing that the TYT audience is out there listening and I feel so connected to civilization. For the first time in 10 months. It's
awesome.
Fantastic.
Well, yeah. we're gonna update you on some of the news that's been going on over the past few months in what's left of America. So that should be fun. You know, it reminds me a little bit of you've done a lot of traveling for shows because you've done shows that have filmed all over the place. Like I have not done much of that, but when I did do my climate change docuseries, there were a few weeks that I spent out on a ship and we didn't have like 30 minutes of enough internet to send an email basically a day. And it was kind of nice to be like out of touch on the news. And this was during the first year of the Trump presidency. So I kept like hoping like when we dock again, it'll have all been resolved somehow. Didn't work out that way, unfortunately.
There is a, you know, when you're out shooting for whatever show that I've been out on in on location, as they say, or roaming around the country, you are untethered from sort of time and space, and no one really knows where you are because you're moving around the country so much. And there is so much freedom in that. I'm finding this is kind of the flip side of that, where I'm. You know, we're on our lockdown, as they say, and we're limiting any kind of contact with anybody who's from the outside. And so I feel untethered, but at home. And it's the oddest dynamic.
Yeah.
There's something also kind of nice about it. I'm not sure I want to go back to the regular world where I have to talk to people.
Yeah, yeah. I know everyone's sort of wondering to what extent we will be able to go back to all that.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Thank God.
We can't wait to have you back in. I'm wondering if we'll have a big packed power panel within 1 year of the lockdown. It's sort of not looking that way, but
is it possible to get us together again?
Yeah. we will definitely see.
I remember
Hazmat.
You start the show, but I remember you had me on the day after Trump's win, And I was sitting in this kind of adjacent little studio area, and Cenk was talking, mm-hmm. and you were there, and everyone was there. And Cenk kind of did this thing where he like turned to me, but I was off camera. And he said, "Hey, Brian, what do you think is going to happen now that Trump is president?" And I just remember naively saying, because he kind of put me on the spot, I said, "Well, I think no institution of government will ever be the same again." And that was the only thing I had. I just right off the top, and I just remember how I think about that often and how naive a statement it was, but at the same time, just how prescient and
not inaccurate.
How couldn't have overstated that enough. Yeah. But anyways, enough about me.
Exactly. Let's turn now to the news. Everyone is watching, whether you're on YouTube, Twitch, the members, Twitter, anything. Thank you for watching. Really appreciate you being here. Feel free to hit the like button and share the stream so that more people know we're active. And we feed the algorithm the things that it eats, likes, bells, whatever it is. And as you chat along with us and send us super chats and tweets and things like that, we will respond between these stories. But with that, there is a lot of news to get to. So let's jump right into the breaking news of the morning. When we found out just a day ago that Rudy Giuliani had apparently been diagnosed with COVID-19, the odds of Jenna Ellis, co-lawyer for the president, getting it seemed to have gone up. They've been near each other quite recently, unmasked, with Rudy letting loose with flatulence nearby. And apparently, the COVID chickens have come home to roost. President Trump's lawyer, Jenna Ellis, has informed associates she has coronavirus, multiple sources tell Axios, stirring West Wing fears after she attended a senior staff Christmas party on Friday. Let's stop there for just one second. A senior staff Christmas party on Friday. They had a Christmas party for their staff. That's madness.
It's madness, and it's just, yeah. I was thinking about the you know, I'm watching Heaven's Gate, and like we're basically just witnessing a cult here where even the threat of death will not deter someone from getting together in a room with another person. If you can't threaten someone with death and change their behavior, what's gonna work? What would work?
Yeah, well, with these in general, I don't think anything. With these particular people, I think cutting off their grifty income might be more effective than the threat of death. But that's about it, really.
Maybe the answer to basically deprogramming anyone in a cult is just cutting their meals.
Exactly. The issue with a cancel strategy in this case is that the only people who do believe that the threat of death should matter aren't the ones who have any sway over her, and we don't provide her income. So we're sort of defenseless or weaponless in this case. So but apparently,
let me ask you, who's handling all of the pressing, urgent legal proceedings now?
I mean, look, so Rudy Giuliani, I had heard, was supposed to be virtually involved in some sort of hearing as early as this morning. We don't know exactly what his condition is like. They say that he's feeling good and doesn't have a fever, but he also was almost immediately checked into a hospital. So that would then seem to throw it to Jenna Ellis, who supposedly has it. Although, let me run through a couple of these graphics, because she does dispute it, which is important, and we should acknowledge that. Bear in mind that three senior White House officials informed Axios of her diagnosis, leading to concerns that that party we talked about could become a super spreader event. She was apparently there, a guest of Peter Navarro, wasn't wearing a mask, because why would you? It's only the dark winter. We know that people brought their families there. Now, when Jonathan Swan asked Ellis about his reporting that she had tested positive and that some senior staff weren't happy about it, she replied that it was rude to text her after midnight, adding, "You must be more informed than me because I haven't heard it." So she denies that it's actually true. And by the way, I don't think that she was quarantining between when Rudy Giuliani was confirmed to have it and today. So will it actually change her behavior? That I don't know, if it turns out that she does.
You know, I support their First Amendment right to ignore a life-threatening virus. I really do. I support their ability to say whatever crap they would like to say. I just want them to get to the back of the line for the vaccine. I just think that that requires Pfizer or Moderna or whoever's controlling the lineup to move them to the rear of the line. You know what I'm saying? Kind of like the way I get turned away at Ralph's if I don't have my mask. I want them to sort of go to the back of the line or come back when they've basically gotten their attitudes right.
Yeah, I think that that makes a lot of sense. Unfortunately, I'm gonna say my gut tells me that there is going to be a direct correlation between how awful a person is and how quickly they get that vaccine. It's gonna be immediate.
I know, it is. It is a sad. They'll be first in line for that.
100%.
Yeah.
And so, look, we talked about yesterday on the show after it was revealed that Rudy Giuliani had it. Friend of the show, Emma Vigeland, she had tweeted about some of the sort of highlights of Rudy's last month or two, of the crazy things that he's done and been involved in. And Jenna Ellis attacked Emma, calling her evil for like wanting someone to get COVID, even though Emma didn't say anything like that. And the thing is, I don't want Jenna Ellis to have COVID. I don't even want Rudy Giuliani to have COVID. I've lost a family member to COVID. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemies, and these are them. But at a certain point, like, they're worried now that that party is gonna be a super spreader event. They've already had two White House based super spreader events, and they keep throwing parties. Mike Pompeo is gonna have a 900 person Christmas party. Like, at what point, like, there's a big gap between wanting someone to have COVID and I guess saying, yeah, no, you did everything you could have possibly done to get it. Am I supposed to have empathy to spare at this point for these people?
Well, you're having a natural reaction as a human being with empathy, and I think that's terrific, and I commend you for it. I generally am, I think there need to be consequences and repercussions, and typically, whatever those are, we're never gonna learn of them factually anyway. So if, like, for instance, Giuliani's hair dye is running everywhere in the hospital room, and he's really sick, and he's, you know, on death's door, we'll never know, because they'll somehow camouflage just how sick they are. But, you know, they always minimize how sick they get. And they're also getting access, as we know, to these sort of latest therapies. And the vampire blood, whatever they're drinking over there, baby blood, whatever, pig blood. So I don't think we'd ever know, but I think it's a very human reaction to want consequences. Mm-hmm. You don't want anyone to die, right? You don't want anyone to you just don't. But, you know, I don't know. Giuliani's ex-wife might feel differently. I don't know.
Yeah. I think what you're talking about is sort of like that sort of primal impetus that leads to religion. It's this desire to live in a cause and effect, fact-based universe, that there will be patterns that we can discern, that behaviors will lead to predictable outcomes. We clearly don't live in that, whether, you know, because they're all getting it and they're all basically surviving, except for Herman Cain. Whether it's the vampire blood, or we've long talked about the monkey antibodies that they're clearly getting.
Yeah.
They always get something that perks them right back up, and they're perfectly fine. But yeah.
And just even on the face of it, the cognitive dissonance that it requires to be someone who's in the faith and in the cult, where you basically, you see these people getting sick, you see them succumbing, and then yet you still believe that something is just like the flu. Or who gives a crap? I'm gonna go to this rally anyway and not wear a mask, or I'm gonna go to this event or a Christmas party. I mean, these are people. Here's the deal. What's that company that goes into buildings and sterilizes the whole place? You see those commercials? You know those guys?
That's like for bugs?
Yeah, for all kinds of stuff. Like when you have a suit or you have some kind of a mite infestation or something.
I assume that was the mob that did that.
Think about what they're gonna do to the White House. It's literally like going into a frat house and having to like clean up all the beer bottles. You're like, you're gonna have to sterilize, you're gonna have to strip the paint. That place is a COVID nesting zone. There are parties, there are bedrooms. I mean, if I were Joe Biden, would you sleep in the bedroom? Would you go into the bathroom and take a shower?
I would bleach it myself. I don't like cleaning bathrooms. I would make an exception. Maybe the bedroom, the bed though.
Ooh.
No.
I wouldn't.
No.
I just wouldn't. You know, like after the inauguration, when he's supposed to go right back to the White House, I would do something like, thank you so much for the impressive house. It's really lovely, but my wife and I are going to stay at the Hampton Inn just down the road.
Yeah, maybe make it the Four Seasons. Anyway.
Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. I would clean that out.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Massive breaking news yesterday, late last night actually, from the New York Times, having to do with the before the vaccines came out, the deals that were set up by the Trump administration with a variety of different companies to purchase those. And apparently one of them with Pfizer, a vaccine that we now know is apparently quite effective, could have been a much bigger deal, and they passed on it. Before Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine was proved highly successful, this just last month, the company offered the Trump administration the chance to lock in supplies beyond the 100 million doses the pharmaceutical maker agreed to sell the government as part of a $1.95 billion deal months ago. The vaccine being produced by Pfizer and its German partner BioNTech is a two-dose treatment, meaning that those 100 million doses are enough for 50 million Americans, not 100 million Americans. But the administration, according to people familiar with the talks, never made the deal, a choice that now raises questions about whether the United States allowed other countries to take its place in line. They had the option to purchase 100 million to 500 million additional doses. And they were told at the time that if they don't lock that in, the demand, you know, from all of the rest of humanity was going to be such that they might have to wait quite a while. Those 500 million additional doses that we could have gotten for, I'm gonna spitball the math and say less than $10 billion, could have inoculated basically everyone in America effectively, and they chose not to. Doesn't mean that we're not gonna get vaccines, but Brian, that is a very weird choice to make in the run up to an election just a couple of months ago.
Yeah, at least it's consistent with the incompetence that we've witnessed. I just think we're that much closer to a zombie apocalypse where basically everyone's outside CVS or some grocery store where they get their flu shots expecting the coronavirus vaccine, screaming masses. You know, if we don't get this thing distributed in an efficient way, I don't know what the consequences were. I mean, there was a part of me today that felt this kind of like disappointment when I saw, and this is totally unjustified, but seeing these two British senior citizens get the vaccine shots today, the first two patients outside of clinical trials to receive that, I just thought, wow, we really have slipped, haven't we? Like I always come back to the whole man on the moon thing. Like we were able to do that, but we cannot figure out a way to stem this spread. And yeah. So yeah, America is we're number four, and we're number one in cases, but we're number four in trying to eradicate this thing. But yeah, I mean, what do you think that is? The what is the rationale for saying, wait, you have the cure? You know what? Just give me a couple. Leave the rest. Leave the rest in the trunk. Yeah. We'll pick it up later. Yeah.
I can only speculate. And look, I want to apologize to the audience. I'm laughing. It's my defense mechanism. When things are so horrific, so dark, I laugh. But really, like, if this means that your average person on average has to wait 1 month or 2 months, you know, to get the vaccine, because we're apparently like not expected to have vaccinated most of America until the end of next summer. Mm-hmm. Like, what are we hoping, that only kills 10,000 more people, that doesn't lead to 100,000 more deaths? It's definitely going to kill a lot of people. The question really is, does it kill an Afghanistan of America's, or a Vietnam of America's, or a Civil War of America's? Like, that's really the question at this point. Why they did this, I don't know. Look, they have deals with other companies, and there are other, you know, other sets of 100 million doses. But this one was considered one of the most likely to work. It had been being worked on for a very long time. When you have the option to purchase more, it either signals, you know, a lack of seriousness in general about the disease and the need to fight it, or a lack of, I mean, just a lack of pragmatism in terms of politics, because if this news had come out before the election, it would have been even worse for him. I can't think of any plausible rational explanation for it. I just can't.
I know I play a lawyer on TV, but I also play a doctor on Yellowstone. So I'm totally qualified to talk about these things. Probably more so than that guy who was advising Trump. But I do think that since they have unlocked the hardest, most difficult part of the vaccine, this messenger RNA kind of delivery system of the vaccine, it opens the door to many companies coming out with many, many vaccines. I'm just hoping by like January, February, there are four or five companies that can flood the zone with this thing. And it can be as easy as going to Rite Aid or CVS. Yeah. And thankfully, we're not just depending on one vaccine from one company. And yeah. Listen, we've gotten through this on our own from the very beginning. We've never depended on this federal government to deliver anything that resembles an effective, efficient sort of address of this crisis. And so we're all on our own. And the only hope is that these pharmaceutical companies that love money more than anything else, there'll be like five or six of them. And we can get this vaccine, I don't know, down the street. That's exactly my hope, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and we have two, Pfizer and Moderna, that had very good results. Just this morning, breaking news, AstraZeneca says that theirs is about 70% effective. I'm not a doctor even on Yellowstone, so I don't know exactly how much worse. I mean, okay, I know it's 20% worse, but sure. I'm now, the thing is, when you have like Pfizer 95, Moderna 90, AstraZeneca 70, as a regular person, the only takeaway I have from that is a fear that I'm gonna get stuck with the AstraZeneca one. I know it. I'm gonna have to wait 6 months and it's gonna be AstraZeneca, and I'm gonna have to take it, because how do you not take it? But yeah, no, anyway.
You don't wanna get stuck with the cheap stuff. You really wanna get the high dollar vaccine. You wanna get that 94% exactly one. And I agree. So I don't know, yeah, take two vaccines of the 70% efficacy and you'll have 140% efficacy.
That's what you get from a TV doctor.
That's correct.
Now this big New York Times revelation that the Trump administration passed on a possible chance to lock in far more doses of the Pfizer vaccine is being disputed by Kayleigh McEnany, who notably swore she would never lie to us. Here she is.
Was there a negotiation at all, or are you guys denying the numbers of doses that were under negotiation?
According to the people involved in the negotiation, it just simply was not true. This president contracted for doses of this vaccine from many different companies, 100 million doses, and those involved in the negotiation say it's just simply not true.
So you're in a position now of having several other companies that potentially could bring vaccines. Is that part of the reason why the administration simply passed, if they did?
No. The administration didn't pass. We contracted with many other companies. There are six vaccines in phase three clinical trial with almost all of them. In fact, I believe it was all six, but I can check on that for you. We contracted for 100 million doses. It's something novel, something Obama-Biden failed to do with the swine flu. It's never been done, and that's credit to having a businessman in the White House. Thank you, Joe.
Really quick question. Sorry,
You show a lot of confidence in your argument when you end it and then immediately bolt away. So you seem to have a reaction to the swine flu thing.
You're talking about your prowess and your competence at sort of coming up with this vaccine, and and then she went to the Christmas party right after that. You really do have to be in two places mentally at the same time to make that happen, where you just talk about how expert you are and then you go and ignore all the science. So why would we trust anything they say that comes out of them? I trust nothing. And it is, and on a serious note, John, as you alluded to, I talked to my mom this morning. She's 86. She's making Christmas cookies in the kitchen that I won't eat this year, and I haven't seen her in a year, and I worry about her. But my brothers and I have like constructed a web of support network around her to make sure they're checking on her each day. And here's my thing. This morning I thought about that, and I go, I hope she makes it to the vaccine. Like I hope, and I hope that for everyone. I hope that the people don't get sick a week before the vaccine comes out at Rite Aid. You know what I'm saying? That's
but the people will. Yeah.
And they're going to die. People will die. And that's why this is so catastrophic. I just hope we make it to the finish line, you know?
Yeah. It was probably a couple months ago. But I compared it to, back when like the end of World War II was formally signed, and how it takes days to get out in those days to all of the soldiers. And so for days, people are still fighting and dying in a war that's over. Like, and so that's why to see people going to Thanksgiving and planning these big Christmases, it's like the only question now is how many people are going to die before nobody needs to die anymore. You're 100% right. And it's going to be a lot, and people are going to get sick the day before, the week before, the month before. As to Kayleigh McEnany's statement, that was technically a denial. She said it wasn't true, but it wasn't much of a denial. I mean, she said there's one thing was objectively untrue. She said that people involved in the negotiation said that it's false. Okay, maybe there are people who said it's false, but the New York Times also has people who say it's true. So I'm going to call that a wash, and I'm going to lean towards the New York Times there. Other than that, she didn't provide any new information that demonstrated that the reporting was false. She said, no, we didn't pass. We contracted with six different companies for 100 million. Okay, that doesn't say that you didn't pass. That says that you did deals with other companies. We're saying Pfizer. Did you get a chance to purchase more doses from Pfizer and you passed on it? You kept saying that that's not true, but then you talked about things that had nothing to do with that. That implies to me, factoring in the context of you being a massive liar, that you probably did pass. And look, I feel my heart can go out to Kayleigh McEnany. Maybe if it was up to her, they wouldn't have. Maybe she, like me and Brian, don't understand why they did, but it's your job to defend that, and you're running. You are literally retreating from those questions. But it's not like they're gonna go away. You're gonna have to answer at some point.
Yeah, and then perhaps give context. I mean, perhaps it is more appropriate to say, yes, we did order this many, but factoring in the other companies, we will have this many doses. And look, I like this general with the US Army who's basically saying, I got this. I trust that guy. I don't know why, I just do. I feel like that guy is not. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
No.
I'm sure your audience does, and I'm sure I'll be attacked for basically cozying up to the military, but I so much so. But this guy's kind of in charge of the distribution. And my brother was in the Army, a retired colonel, and he called me up and he says, Brian, don't worry, this guy's got it. I know the kind of guy he is, there was something about his take command attitude and leadership that he was exerting that kind of gave me, or asserting, that made me feel like he was gonna. So I've been listening to that guy, not Ms. Kayleigh McEnany.
Yeah, probably a good call. Regardless of what person you insert into that guy, probably a better idea to listen to that guy than Kayleigh, but definitely after the show, let me know who you're talking about.
I will.
With that, why don't we switch it up, talk about something very different. The Trump challenges to election results in multiple battleground states continue, and his clashes with Republican leadership in those states continues as well. In today's pre-show, I talked about the pressure he was putting on Pennsylvania Republicans, and they're apparently standing up to that at least a little bit. But it's even worse in Georgia, with Georgia's Governor Brian Kemp again telling lawmakers that he won't call a special session of the legislature to overturn Georgia's election results and appoint 16 presidential electors who would support Trump instead of Biden, you know, the guy who won the election. Specifically, he put out a statement with Republican Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan, both Republicans, saying any attempt by the legislature to retroactively change that process for the November 3rd election would be unconstitutional and immediately enjoined by the courts, resulting in a long legal dispute and no short-term resolution. Well, this comes just a couple of days after Trump and Kemp spoke by phone, hours before Trump's rally in Georgia on Saturday. The president asked Kemp to order the legislative session and the governor refused. According to a tweet from the governor, Trump also asked him to order an audit of absentee ballots from the presidential race in the state. Kemp has said he can't do that because he has no authority to interfere in the electoral process on Trump's behalf. In Trump's defense, Kemp has seemingly had a very high opinion of his ability to interfere in election results in the past. So I can understand Trump's frustration in this case, the fact that he's not doing it. But Trump is attacking him, tweeting that he's a rhino, saying he'll be solely responsible for the potential loss of our two great senators from Georgia if he doesn't overturn the election that already happened. I don't really understand that. But Brian, it is interesting and novel to see Trump going at it with a governor who's not a Democrat for once, that he's really sticking it to this Republican.
Hold on a second, let me put back my lawyer. You know, as a lawyer on a popular television show, on a very credible legal broadcast on the FX television network, I ask you this, when speaking of unconstitutional, I just wonder, like, when does it become a crime for someone to keep picking up the phone and applying this pressure, trying to overturn a democracy? When does that, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what legal body or what law enforcement body would enforce anything like that, since they're all so like corrupt at this point. But like, I'm just wondering, like, how many states can you call and pressure before someone says that's illegal? I mean, I went to a very, very, very credible legal institution. I got my diploma from the Hollywood School of Acting Legal College, and I can smell a crime. I smell it.
I remember there was talk after, like, I believe it was within a week of the election, when Senator Lindsey Graham called up, I think it was Raffensperger in Georgia, and told him to like reject a bunch of votes. And people were like, hey, like, you can't tell someone to commit election fraud. That's itself a crime. And then, you know, America did what America does, which is that's a powerful person. And there was a lot of other news, so we all forgot about it, including me until this moment. And there were no consequences. Trump is gonna be fine. He can do, like, I love that, like, the only defense really against all of what Trump is doing is, it probably won't work. The coup probably won't, we'll probably still have democracy in a month. And everybody's like perfectly content to slide on that. Like, it probably won't work here.
Yes.
That seems dangerous.
And the silence among, you know, Republicans is obviously something media likes to jump on and harp on and talk about all the time. But I wanna, like, I look no further than Hollywood. When you're no longer in the chair and you don't have the big job, once you leave the building, nobody cares. Nobody gives a crap that you were there, because there's your mind moves on to the next thing anyway. So his influence over the party is overstated. That's my opinion. And then secondly, there's always someone there to take your place. There's always someone who wanted the job and wants it so badly that they essentially kind of erase you from the, you know, the popular lexicon. So I just wish that folks would understand that his, you know, this whole effect he will have on the Republican Party and on America's conference. No, you kind of slip away. You really do. Johnny Carson went and played tennis in Malibu. Seinfeld even became more of an emeritus kind of like comedian. And once he was off the show, it's not like they affect the everyday and drive the everyday pop culture. And I think politics is the same way. Once you're gone, you're gone. So everybody just kind of just, you know, do your own thing. Don't worry about this guy. Once he's gone, he's gone. So that's, stand up, have
that's
a conscience.
That's a bold prediction, actually.
And this is just a year from now, you and I will share this moment, reshare it. And you'll say, Brian,
that he'll be gone.
You are so wrong.
We'll see, we'll see. Like, I think the audience right now is processing your prediction. And again, it is bold. No, not a lot of people are predicting that in a year, Trump isn't going to be a significant factor in the Republican Party. My gut like reaction would be, well, but Trump is doing all of this planning. Like him and his kids, they're getting ready. They're going to take over the RNC here. And then he's going to be in charge of the NRA. And they're going to be spooling up for a presidential run. They're ready. They're not going to be irrelevant because they're ready. But the thing is, apparently behind the scenes, Trump is not necessarily in this like house of cards planning the next seven steps sort of phase. At least as a result, or I'm saying this as a result of this bit of insider information about what he's actually focused on a day-to-day basis today.
Talked to this person said the president basically has, you know, 75 versions of the exact same conversation every single day with whoever walks in to the Oval Office. You cannot get him to focus on the topic at hand. And, you know, the only variation is whatever sort of new conspiracy theory he has seen on Newsmax or OAN or has been brought to him, you know, by an ally who believes in this stuff or at least wants to encourage the president. And that's where he is right now. So he is sort of stuck somewhere in stages of grief and acceptance purgatory and not really moving on.
Like, I know for some of the audience, they're like, I don't care what Trump is thinking, and I get that. I do get that. But like, I've been really wondering, does he actually think he has a chance, or is he just doing this as a facade while he, you know, does his Machiavellian stuff behind the scenes? That would seem to indicate, no, he really thinks he's still going to be president or has a good chance. He really, like someone described him, I think it was Mary Trump, described him as the only person who can successfully gaslight himself. And maybe he has, maybe this is evidence of that.
We will never hear from him again as a candidate. He will fade away. He is constructing this sort of legacy of his right now, where he will always be the wronged victim. He will live out the rest of his days as a victim. And he will never, ever subject himself to the risk of losing again. He will never do that. I hope he does run again, because it would just be like a defeat, even double the size that it is now. The threat of him coming back is way worse than the one that we're enduring now. His presence now is like Trump light. Can you imagine the guy in 4 years occupying the White House? I mean, nothing would rally the base more. So he will fade away. He will spit into a bucket on a front porch in Mar-a-Lago. And he will bitch and moan about, and to anyone who will listen. And you know, and then and his rocking chair will just sort of go and go and go to the end of days, his days. But he can go on OAN and all of these other French places, but even the media machine, it's just all they want is money too. And at some point they want to go on to the next superstar, whoever that's gonna be. So yeah. My prediction is the guy just fades away, kind of like, you know, will always, you know, like whatever happened to that guy? Because that's what people say about me. So I really, that's what I believe.
You want that for your own worst enemy. Okay, well, someone in the audience, remind us in 1 year, please. Whatever the date is, just, you know, next year, we'll find out.
Okay.
With that, let's talk about something very, very different and very local to both Brian and myself. LA has got a new DA, and George Gascon is not waiting a long time to put into effect the sort of agenda he had been campaigning on. On just his first day leading the country's largest district attorney's office, top prosecutor in LA County announced a series of sweeping criminal justice reforms aimed at permanently changing the course of California's criminal justice system. Gascon said, I recognize for many this is a new path, Whether you are a protester, a police officer, or a prosecutor, I ask you to walk with me. I ask you to join me on this journey. We can break the multi-generational cycles of violence, trauma, and arrest and recidivism that has led America to incarcerate more people than any other nation. Now, I can't speak necessarily for the protesters or the prosecutors, but I'm going to guess that many of the police officers, or at least the representation, are not going to be walking with him. But here are a few of the changes, and then we'll have a little discussion. He tweeted a number of them. Enhancements, a legacy of the tough on crime era, are a principal driver of excessive sentences and mass incarceration. California enacted over 100 enhancements, which are outdated, incoherent, and applied unfairly. To end mass incarceration in LA, we will cease filing all enhancements. He talks about the effect that the three strikes law had on the prison population in California, and says that three strikes ends in my office beginning today. He pledged to reopen four fatal officer-involved shootings, saying my office will now convene a use of force review board to review fatal use of force cases dating back to at least 2012. We must hold police accountable to restore trust in law enforcement. He says that cash bail is going to be ended completely by January 1st, and also says that the death penalty does not make us safer. It's racist, morally untenable, irreversible, and expensive. And today it's off the table. So I would say that's a lot for one day. Mm-hmm. That's a busy first day. I don't know how you follow that up on the second day, but he is hitting a bunch of different areas. These are all things that he campaigned on.
Yeah, and won. You know, it is kind of it's certainly a positive move for progressives. I mean, in terms of reform. And you know, listen, this is another one of those things where you really can't. You know, I have a friend of mine is in the LAPD, and there is no middle ground. We never, ever, ever find any middle ground in our discussions about reform. And so I don't really have an answer. We just try to maintain a friendship and outside of talk of criminal reform. You know, I like data, and I think like these stats don't lie. And you also have, you know, the softer data, which is what this, you know, this generational cycle that you do have to break. So listen, I, you know, let's live this, give this guy a shot and see what happens. I hope there's
Yeah, look, I don't have close relationships with many cops, but I'm seeing the response to Gascon with the police union. You know, let's see what's their particular quote. Los Angeles Police Union called the reforms disturbing and potentially disastrous, saying Gascon is exploring every avenue possible to release from jail those responsible for recent rise in violent crime. And so the thing is, at least with the reforms that he's talked about so far, in terms of direct reform to the day-to-day job of a police officer, I mean, the closest thing is investigating past fatal officer-involved shootings. The rest of it is really more about mass incarceration and the way that people are treated once they are involved in that system. It's not really about cops can't do this, they're gonna be reviewed if they do this, strap a body cam onto that. It's not really those sorts of reforms just yet. And so it's interesting that the response is so negative. I understand that they're worried about a slippery slope, they're worried about what happens next or whatever, but I do agree, it really does feel like this is one of those areas, like with, you know, like gun control, where literally nothing can be proposed from the point of view of the entrenched interests. Nothing will be accepted because it's always considered the first step towards, you know, mass roundups of guns or badges, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, listen, why is that growing exponentially? What we have to have a long-term policy fix here, guys. So I guess we will see. I don't know.
We will see. I'm gonna read just one more comment from Gascon. Perhaps, you know, like an image of an idea of what's to come, saying, for those of you who at home may be skeptical, I want to ask you to take a moment, close your eyes, and imagine your ideal safe neighborhood. I imagine most of you will imagine a neighborhood with parks, playgrounds, and manicured lawns, with kids playing and after school programs flourishing. I don't imagine most of you are imagining a neighborhood with a police officer on every corner. We know what safety looks like, but we don't offer it to every community equally. And by the way, I would definitely advise everyone, whether you go to, there's good write-ups on LA Times, NBC News, Common Dreams, and all of that about things he's doing. He's also talking about making sure that we have the right funding to treat people with mental health difficulties, appropriately rather than just funneling it again into the same already overcrowded system. He wants to review cases where people were given really lengthy prison terms and are not considered to be threats of, you know, future criminality or violence or anything like that. People who are much older, nonviolent crimes. Like this is, so there's some specific reforms here, but there's also a philosophical change to a little bit more understanding of the proper use for long-term incarceration and not simply like California has for the last 30 years considered a solution to every societal ill.
Yeah, it sounds very pragmatic and it I don't know if I would even call it progressive. It just sounds like it's treating very logically issues from a guy who really has studied them. He sounds expert. And
yeah.
Wow, what a refreshing thing that is too, to hear from someone who is an expert, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, we could use that for a bit. A former Israeli space security chief, retired Israeli general and current professor Chaim Eshed has sent eyebrows shooting heavenward by saying that Earthlings have been in contact with extraterrestrials from a galactic federation. Chaim said, the unidentified flying objects have asked not to publish that they are here. Humanity is not ready yet. This is according to an interview in Hebrew that ran on Friday and gained traction after parts were published in English by the Jerusalem Post on Tuesday. Question for Chaim, if they said they didn't want you to tell us, seems like sort of a risk to reveal it now, buddy. We've got more, but Brian, what do you think?
Can you please put the graphic back up? I thought that was a very, very accurate depiction of the White House Christmas party.
Can we see the B-roll, everybody?
Back up. There it is. Hey, everybody.
No, Brian.
Merry Christmas from the White House. Anyway,
okay. It's accurate insofar as only one person is wearing a mask, but they are all social distancing. So I'm not sure that's totally accurate.
That is true. Listen, I'm watching Heaven's Gate Cult of Cults on HBO right now. And you know, this belief that aliens are coming and they're taking us to the next level or wherever they're going to take us is so widely held. It's beyond mocking at this point. So my only hope for the entire UFO industry, which is its own industrial complex, is that I hope Trump got the documents about Area 51 and the alien they're keeping alive there. And I hope he busts that thing wide open. If there's one thing I hope he does, it's that. Because you know that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to get into the vaults at Area 51.
You know, it's funny because we actually, there is a little bit about Trump in this in just a moment. I feel like the fact that we've gotten this far into Trump's term, and Trump is a guy who casually declassifies stuff in random conversations and a guy who really likes attention. I feel like it's harder to sustain the belief that anything cool or interesting that the government's been hiding actually exists, because I feel like he would have revealed it. I mean, he's not a very curious person.
He would have.
There
was a piece in the Times yesterday or the day before, like whatever happened to him exposing the whole JFK assassination. He said he was going to go into the file cabinets and pull those files and take a look at it. And so none of that stuff, we've been deprived of the answers to all of the conspiracy theories of our time. But yet somehow History Channel and Discovery Channel still get to make TV shows about it. So this should put an end to everything, because you're right. He would have told those truths. He would have told them all. And they're not there.
And they're not there. And the thing is, we know something's there. So here is the most frustrating thing. If you are either a conspiracy theorist or a rational person, both groups should be frustrated by this. Donald Trump is a guy that is super interested in conspiracy theories. He watches Newsmax and OAN every day. He tweets everything he hears. And whether there are aliens or not, there's definitely cool hidden stuff. He could be finding out the answers to conspiracy theories. Instead, he's only interested in the headlines about them. What a stupid, incurious idiot. Like, you could get real information about Project Northwood, MK Ultra, and whatever.
Yes, think about it. He would be the man who says, Bigfoot is real. Here, we've had one in captivity all this time. He could turn his conspiratorial brain into this heroic kind of sort of the answer man. And he's ignored all of them. And so listen, the guy's ignored greatness at every opportunity. He's never, ever, ever stood up to greatness when it knocks on the door. So why should we count on him to expose aliens? We all know they're there.
We do. We do. And look, honestly, like I've said many times on the show, I definitely believe that there are aliens. I just find it hard to believe that they've actually been here. Or that they would exist
before we could communicate with them. I actually went there. Yeah, and I was chased away by armed guards when we were shooting How the States Got Their Shapes. And so I knew we were getting either close to aliens or just encroaching on a military complex.
It's hard to say. And then it's also hard to say how to respond to this news, because this person's former Israeli space security chief, a general, a professor, apparently a respected professional. But when you're saying that, for instance, we have an underground base in the depths of Mars where American astronauts and alien representatives work together. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to believe that. He must have known that when he said it.
As a Jewish lawyer, I'm very disappointed in this hokey thing. But there's a reason Israel doesn't have a giant space program.
Why is that?
I don't know.
He probably does, though.
Yes, he does.
He probably does.
But by the way, he's pretty sure that it exists. And
Well, interestingly, he didn't say that there were Israeli astronauts working with these people. He did put it all in the US. And he said, by the way, that President Donald Trump is aware of the extraterrestrials' existence and had been on the verge of revealing information, but was asked not to in order to prevent mass hysteria. Yeah, he wouldn't want to cause a panic or anything.
Well, he also doesn't want to be, he doesn't want that giant ass of his probed by the beings, by the aliens.
I guess I should be proud that it took us that long
to get it. The aliens said
no. But it was coming.
Even the aliens said, we're not probing that guy.
Exactly, not interested. So, stop offering.
Yeah,
anyway,
put the diaper back on and let's just call it a day. we're going back to Neptune or wherever the hell we came from.
Exactly. Anyway, we've got one other little quick bit of news, just a fun little moment. So let's do that with the little time we have left. President Donald Trump is still technically president, and he can still technically give out the Medal of Freedom, which he did yesterday afternoon to Dan Gable, a legendary wrestler and a teacher of wrestling. But not long after giving him the medal, people started asking questions, and it very quickly got to be a bit too much for President Trump, who's not interested in any of this accountability or media or press or any of that. So this happened.
Mr. President, one more question about the inauguration. Thank you very much.
Anything on Bill Barr, sir?
Congratulations,
sir.
He's gone.
He's gone. He just walked out. He just left. He left an old man just standing there. He's not in charge. That's the Oval Office. You need to be in there.
Do you know how long it took to get those little kids in the background there dressed in those clothes and their hair combed for this little publicity stunt event? It was like such a big deal. And the guy comes in, and then I was thinking, from their perspective, they'll go, I vaguely remember he came into the room and he did something to my grandfather. He put something around his head and then he went, I'm out.
Bye-bye.
Hey, see you later. And my grandfather just stood there without any lines. Look at him.
Yeah, and look, I don't know Dan Gable. I don't know what his politics are. It's possible. I don't know which is worse, if he's a fan of Trump and Trump walked out on his thing, or if he's not a fan of Trump, but he really does want to be acknowledged for a lifetime of work. So he was willing to go, and then the dude just peaced out in the middle of it.
I don't know. It is really, you know, you're complaining that this show's not serious enough today. And I would just say you keep serving up some really wonderful comedic moments. And that is a man who is not a stage performer, this man. He is not trained in the art of now improvising to the press and saying something. So he does what anybody would do. He puts his hands up and he goes, he's gone. Trump.
Yeah, exactly. He's gone,
which is what we're all going to do in January. When the moment comes, we're all just going to go, he's gone.
He's gone. Yeah.
And that's going to be
really fast. I certainly hope so. But really fast, I want to show you that everybody watching this is probably pretty confident that Donald Trump was the most childish person in the room. And it's not for lack of competition. If we could bring up this photo from the event, there was a bit of a hissy fit. Someone landed on the floor. But still, that kid has a shred more quiet dignity than the president.
That is the photo. That might just define, that child represents America.
I'm done.
That's the country right there, folks. Just on the floor, on their back. There will be. What a contrast to that picture of little John Kennedy Jr. popping his head out of the Resolute desk. And you put this one side by side of a kid just passed out on the Oval Office carpet, like. You just can't take it anymore.
No, and I love Trump's little desk sized for that kid, oddly enough. Anyway, Brian Unger, thank you so much for joining us and taking time out. I hope the pandemic's not treating you too bad. 2020 is not treating you too bad. Is there anything coming up in the near future that people can look forward to, or is 2020 being 2020?
I have absolutely nothing to say to look forward to other than all of us sort of getting a vaccine, climbing out of this madness, soldiering on, and never letting the last 4 years happen to us again.
I hope so. Let's look forward to that. Brian, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Good to see you.
So throughout this pandemic, there's been this ongoing national conversation about how fast the economy needs to be reopened. And the focus seems to always be on making sure the corporations are making profits. And sometimes there's sort of vague assertions that we need to make sure that people are keeping their jobs. But the actual condition of those jobs, the way people are being treated during this pandemic, is very rarely anything of a focus for our government. And we're gonna hopefully correct that a little bit in this segment, because we're very lucky to be joined by the president of One Fair Wage, Saru Jayaraman. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thanks for having me.
Very glad to have you on and to talk about this report that your organization put together, talking about both health risks as well as different forms of harassment that service industry employees have been experiencing. So tell me a little bit about what you found in this study.
So some of this stuff was not surprising because of what we know about the industry, what we knew about the industry prior to the pandemic. I like to say that the industry had a pre-existing condition prior to the pandemic. The restaurant industry prior to the pandemic was the nation's second largest and fastest growing employer, but also the absolute lowest paying. And that is partly historical. It's due to the money, power, and influence of the trade lobby, which we call the other NRA, it's the National Restaurant Association, which has been around, it turns out, since emancipation of slavery, when it first demanded the right to hire newly freed slaves, namely Black women, not pay them anything and have them live entirely on tips, which was a mutation of the original concept of tipping. Tipping had originated in feudal Europe as an extra or bonus on top of a wage, but it changed to a replacement for wages because of slavery in the United States, because restaurants did not want to pay Black women in particular. And that became law in 1938 as part of the New Deal. Everybody got the right to the minimum wage for the first time, except for three groups of Black workers, farm workers, domestic workers, and tipped restaurant workers, who went from a $0 wage in 1938 all the way up to the absurd and ridiculous federal minimum wage for tipped workers of $2.13 an hour in 2020. And that was the source of the fact that the restaurant industry had the highest rates of economic instability and sexual harassment of any industry in the United States prior to the pandemic. A mostly female workforce of tipped workers was forced to put up with whatever customers did to them, however they touched them or treated them or talked to them, because the customers were paying their bills, not their employers. There were seven states that did it differently, including where I live in California. They always provided a full minimum wage with tips on top. We found that those states have had one half the rate of harassment in the industry, just proving that when you pay workers a full minimum wage, they don't feel as dependent on customers. That power dynamic that exists between women servers and male customers isn't as great when they get a full minimum wage. Mm-hmm. Well, that power dynamic got so much worse during the pandemic, because during the pandemic, 60% of these workers couldn't get unemployment insurance because most states told them their wages were too low to qualify for benefits. And then when they went back to work, they went back to work for a sub-minimum wage, and tips were down 50 to 75% because sales are down. And here you are, you're a worker, you've gone back to work, you've been unemployed for months with no benefits. If you can only get 25 to 50% of the tips you used to get, every tip becomes more important. Every customer has more power over you because you rely so much more on those tips. And so workers in this study reported that they are exposing themselves to great risk. They are having to do more for less. They're now having to act as public health marshals, enforcing social distancing and mask rules for far less money in tips. And in fact, they said, if we try to enforce these rules, we get less money in tips. Therefore, we feel reluctant to enforce these rules. And that is a public health disaster for both them and the public. Even worse, 40% of the workers reported an increase in sexual harassment during the pandemic, and hundreds of women submitted comments that male customers said to them along the lines of, take your mask off so I can see how cute you are and determine your tip on that basis. Essentially, expose yourself to the virus so I can determine whether I like you, whether I want to tip you, am going to let you have income today. And so sexual harassment and the sub-minimum wage in our industry went from being unjust, racially unjust, sexually, gender-wise, an injustice, to becoming literally a matter of life and death.
Wow, there's already a lot there. And this to everyone watching this, the One Fair Wage, the study is available, and you can see that comments like you just said, there are many of them. I think reasonable person can't imagine someone doing that, but as you pointed out, this is not a brand new thing. This is like an acceleration of what had already been. And of course, I want to focus on first the COVID, because you're talking about expose yourself to the virus, but of course they are, by virtue of the fact that they have to work when many probably would prefer not to have to.
That's right.
Are being exposed every day to many people who might not be wearing masks. And even if they are, they're being exposed to far more people than most of us who might get to work from home and all of that. And I'm assuming that has led to COVID cases and probably deaths in the service industry, correct?
Nearly half of the more than 2,000 workers we surveyed, nearly half said somebody at least one person in the restaurant got COVID. And I was shocked by the data point that a third said they knew somebody had died. That is insane, but it's not surprising when you read the CDC report from September that shows that restaurants are the most dangerous place to be during the pandemic. In fact, a CDC reported in September that adults are twice as likely to get COVID by eating in a restaurant. Now imagine working in a restaurant and all day long being, workers reported, 90% of workers said, almost every shift I'm coming into contact with people who aren't wearing masks, less than 6 feet apart. Lots of people, it's a very, very dangerous environment. Like you said, most workers would choose not to go back to work because it's so dangerous. Those that are going back to work feel they have no other choice, and they're very reliant on these tips to survive. And what they're finding is that harassment has gone up, but so has hostility. When these workers are trying to enforce these rules, they're being met with very aggressive responses, very aggressive rejection of the notion of wearing a mask when you go to the bathroom or sitting 6 feet apart. So the workers are saying, if they're gonna not tip me or respond in a harassing or aggressive way, there is no way I can enforce these rules, which is crazy because given the CDC report, we rely on these workers to enforce these rules if we don't want restaurants to be the source of a massive increase in cases.
Exactly. Yeah, and I would remind the audience, by the way, through the course of the pandemic, we've shown any number of the videos that have gone viral of people harassing those working at grocery stores and at restaurants and things like that. For every person that filmed themselves doing it, there are obviously many that did not. And yeah, that experience on top of all the other dangers, the fear that some irresponsible person is gonna get you sick. I did wanna ask you a question about one thing. So you mentioned that many people weren't able to transition into unemployment because their wages were determined to be too low, which is just insult to injury right there. Right. Have there been any state or federal efforts to correct that as the pandemic continued?
Well, so the Federal CARES Act, the first and second rounds, you know, provided unemployment insurance, $600 a week to workers regardless of their income. So that was supposed to correct the fact that most states denied these workers in the largest industry any kind of benefits. But what we heard from thousands of workers is because that federal money came through the state unemployment insurance systems, they weren't able to access it. I'll give you an example. We have a worker leader in Michigan, small town in Michigan, where the wage is $3.52 an hour for tipped workers. She said, "I reported my tips religiously to the IRS, but because my boss didn't, when I went to apply, they denied me. The state of Michigan denied me unemployment insurance. Then I was told I was able to get the federal pandemic unemployment assistance, the PUA, through the CARES Act, $600 a week. I was told I was eligible, but when I tried to access it, the state denial resulted in me never being able to access the federal funds." So thousands of these workers have gone 6, 9, 10 months with nothing, no income, no benefits from state or federal government, no safety net. And so you're looking at mass destitution, starvation, evictions, not able to pay heat bills with winter coming. It's a terrifying situation at a scale that I don't think people realize. This is an industry of 13.6 million workers. Almost 1 in 10 American workers is struggling in this situation right now.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't get that. And based on the behavior of Congress as they're continuing those negotiations on further stimulus, it doesn't seem like they get it. Maybe having a few more congresswomen who were recently bartenders could be a good thing,
right,
to connect them a bit to the experience of so many millions of employees. So looking forward, what would either you or One Fair Wage like to see done to fix this problem as quickly as possible during the pandemic, but also possibly to make a little bit of headway in reducing some of the insane conditions that existed before the pandemic?
That's exactly it. You hit it on the head. We cannot go back to the way things were. It never worked for this massive workforce and frankly for the majority of working people. So what we need is federally the Raise the Wage Act to pass. The Raise the Wage Act passed in the House last July. It proposed a $15 minimum wage and full elimination of the subminimum wage for tipped workers, meaning everybody in the country in the restaurant industry, minimum wage workers, would get a full minimum wage with tips on top. That passed in the House. Of course, it didn't move with Mitch McConnell in the Senate, but Joe Biden, the Biden-Harris campaign, endorsed the Raise the Wage Act on three different parts of their campaign platform. And so we know that if the Senate flips, it can and should move in the Senate. If the Senate doesn't flip, there's a lot a new Biden-Harris administration could still do through executive actions. For example, incentivizing restaurants to move to a one fair wage model, because so many restaurants are struggling right now. A lot would respond to a cash incentive and say, okay, I'll transition to a full minimum wage. But there's so much also that could be done at the state level. Governor Cuomo committed, for example, in New York to move to a full minimum wage with tips on top 2 years ago. With this new report, we hope that he understands this is a COVID emergency. This is a COVID crisis. Now has the time has come for states like New York and Massachusetts and Illinois and places like DC to enact a full minimum wage with tips on top. Because here's the thing, we're all out there clapping for essential workers. Well, this is frankly the largest workforce of private sector essential workers. We are relying on them to enforce these rules. But they're the only essential workers that don't get a minimum wage. We're not even talking hazard pay or anything else, just a minimum wage. And they're the only essential workers who are being asked to remove their protective gear to get their income. That is a crisis for them. And it is a crisis for any governor, any state legislature that's worried about the current terrifying increase in cases.
Exactly. Everything that you just said seems like such common sense, which makes me worried about the chance that it's going to be done, but hopefully it can. And I'm glad that you targeted multiple levels of the government, as well as not just in the government, but also the owners of some of these restaurants, which can, they could switch over to this. They could take these instances of harassment a lot more seriously. But I do appreciate the work that the organization is doing, and I hope that people are listening. Thank you so much for joining us. Really do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.